This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If you listen to the Eye on the Sky weather reports today, you're up to speed on how we're in the midst of yet another below-average week of temperatures. Pretty par for the course for 2015 so far. But the sun, when it gets a chance to shine, has already been warming up the top layer of your soil, and you may already have been outside planting some hardy greens. Not to mention the seedlings dedicated gardeners have been nurturing indoors. So today on the show, we're going to defy the weather gods and talk as if it really feels like spring. We have brought back gardening consultant Charlie Nardozzi to offer tips and advice and to tell us about some of the new products out there for controlling pests that he's been trying out. Charlie, nice to have you back on the show.
It's great to be here, Jane.
Convince me, it's really spring?
It's really spring.
All right. Well, listeners, if you have a question for Charlie, if you want to convince us that it really is spring, tell us how you're getting your garden to grow already. You can post a note or a photo on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Or give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That number again is 1-800-639-2211. Before we get into planting and weeding and all of that fun stuff, Charlie, let's just give some closure to the winter season that was. And specifically, I'd love to talk a little bit about what people can do if they saw some damage this winter. I know many of us did. Mm-hmm. My pine trees got nailed, and
yes,
they look pretty lousy.
Pretty bad, right.
So let's talk a little bit about repairing the damage from the
yes,
winter. Not the emotional damage, the landscaping
damage. There is that, too.
Damage. Yeah.
That's right. You're seeing these trees and these limbs hanging down and broken split branches.
Right.
Right. So obviously, if you have any broken branches, whether it be on trees or shrubs, as all the snow and the ice is finally melted and you're starting to see the scope of the damage, you'll need to cut those back.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't really matter the time of year. Go ahead and cut them back. The key, though, is, for example, a white pine. I was doing the exact same thing this weekend, cleaning up some white pines in our property. And you don't want to cut them back just to where they split, but you should really cut them way back, like back to either a main branch or back to the actual trunk itself.
Okay.
Even if that means taking off some nice-looking growth, because that's going to allow the tree to heal better. If you just leave a stub there, if you just cut it part of the way back, it's not going to heal very well. Then you also have to assess, especially on some shrubs, whether they're worth keeping. I mean, especially like a rhododendron, for example, maybe had a lot of snow, ice on it, broke a bunch of branches. You look at the leaves, they're all shriveled and brown. You really have to kind of make an assessment. Now, for a broadleaf evergreen like a rhododendron, you might have brown leaves, but it doesn't mean that the plant is dead. You can just pick those leaves off and just actually do a little test clip, I might say, to see if that wood is still green inside.
Uh-huh.
If it is, chances are it'll probably leaf back out for you and survive. If it's brown, brown's not a good color for inside. So you probably have at least portions of that shrub that are dead, and either you can decide at that point to pull it out or just cut it way back.
Okay, so that's the way to tell is do that little test clip, see what the wood is doing.
See what the wood is doing. Same thing with roses, same thing with any perennials that you might have out there that are woody kind of perennials. If you clip into the wood and you see that it's brown, or if it's kind of a tan colored,
mm-hmm,
tan isn't a good color either. You're looking for green.
So for something, though, like a rose,
mm-hmm,
could you just cut that right back to the roots and then let it grow again? Or are you saying pull it and put in a new plant?
Well, it depends on the rose you have. So if you have roses like the old-fashioned roses, some of the landscape roses, especially roses that are grown on their own root, meaning that they weren't grafted roses,
mm-hmm,
sure, you can cut them right back to the ground, and whatever comes out of the ground, out of that root system, which chances are probably did survive, will grow up and actually flower for you again this year. But if you do have some of the modern hybrids, the hybrid teas, floribundas, the ones that are grafted and they have that little bulge right down by the soil line, that's the graft union. If that has died down to that bulge so that everything has died above that graft union, then whatever comes out of the soil is not the same variety.
Mm-hmm.
I always get this question on different places where I speak, is that, Charlie, it's a miracle. Last year, it was a white rose. This year, it's a red rose. And what happened? It was no miracle. It's just that the top died back and the rootstock grew up, and that's a different colored rose.
Good trick, though.
It is a good trick.
So we got a note from Karen in Moortown who says, phosphorus is the problem in Lake Champlain. We're hearing a lot about this.
Yes.
Karen says, and it's going to cost Vermont hundreds of millions of dollars to remove phosphorus from our stormwater runoff and the lake in compliance with EPA mandates. Over on the Connecticut Riverside, nitrogen's the problem, and we're going to be faced with the same requirements.
Mm-hmm.
So Karen's question for you, Charlie, is how to be careful about whether or not you actually need any phosphorus or nitrogen on your garden, how to make absolutely sure that it stays in your garden and does not migrate to ditches, brooks, puddles, and the like.
Yes.
Given that this is on the minds of many Vermonters right now, mm-hmm, can you talk a little bit about phosphorus and
sure,
nitrogen?
Sure. Yeah. So first with phosphorus. Now, there are no phosphorus fertilizers on the market now. And in fact, it is a state law that you cannot apply phosphorus phosphorus fertilizer to lawns any longer. So that would be the first step, is just get a fertilizer that has no phosphorus in it. But even before that, you actually should do a soil test. So whether it be a perennial garden, vegetable garden, lawn, whatever areas in your area, in your yard that you are growing, do a soil test and find out what the phosphorus levels are. Chances are they're above medium, sometimes high, sometimes even excessive. It's obvious then that you're not going to need to be applying any phosphorus in any form, way, shape, or form at all. So that would be kind of the first thing that you want to do. Once you've done that, then you want to take a look at if you have to apply phosphorus. Say you have one of those soils that is low in phosphorus, and then at that point you will have to apply some. When you apply it, take a look at the organic forms of phosphorus, you know, something that has a rock phosphate, something that's slow release, because the slow release forms of those, we're going to obviously leach slowly into the soil as the plants need it and won't be quickly running off into any kind of waterways. So getting the right kind of fertilizer and make sure you need it in the first place is the first line of defense. For nitrogen, nitrogen's a little different. Phosphorus stays in the soil for a long time and slowly kind of builds up. Nitrogen is very volatile. So you put it down this year and it's kind of gone by the growing season, by mid-growing season or late growing season. So when you're applying nitrogen fertilizer, apply it for specific uses, for crops that need a lot of it, like corn, for example, or some of the greens that need a lot of quick growth. You can apply nitrogen to those, but use an organic form, again, that will be absorbed quickly into the plant, used, and then that will be it. To just indiscriminately apply nitrogen, like on a lawn, for example, or a field, that's where you start getting running into problems with running off into streams.
Can you go back and give us the plants 101 here and why plants need nitrogen and phosphorus?
Sure. Yeah. So the big three, different than the car makers, is nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. So nitrogen is all about leafy growth. And that's, if anything you're growing needs a lot of leaves, any of the greens you're growing, corn, which is actually technically a grass, any plant like that, or even things like tomatoes and broccolis and flowers, they, especially when they're young, they need a lot of nitrogen to kind of get themselves going and growing strong. So that's when you apply nitrogen, and that's why you apply it. Phosphorus is more about root growth and bulbs, onions, tulips, those kinds of plants, dahlias. So you want to have nice strong roots and nice strong bulbs. That's why you apply phosphorus. Potassium, the third one, the K in the equation, that one is used more for kind of vigor, winter hardiness, just kind of the toughness of the plant. And in fact, a lot of people this time of year would like to apply wood ashes to their gardens to increase the potassium content. And it's a very good way of using an organic source that you might have to increase potassium if you're deficient in it. The only thing you have to watch out for is that that wood ashes also raises the pH of your soil. So you don't want to have a pH much above 7 or so in our area as far as trying to get things to grow. So if you add too many wood ashes, you're going to raise it too high. So you have to be careful. Usually the recommendation is about 20 pounds per 1,000 square feet of your garden. But based on a soil test.
That's why I just put bananas on mine.
There you go.
All right, we're talking to Charlie Nardozzi. If you have a question, a garden question, maybe you're looking at your soil and thinking, how do I prep my soil for this year? What's going on there underground? If you have a question, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's talk about soil.
Let's talk about soil.
What's happening with the frost line? Are we completely frost-free, or is it still pretty cold a couple feet down right now?
Well, I was just mentioning to one of your colleagues here, I was digging in my bark mulch pile that I have from last year, and I was digging in with my tractor, and I hit frost. I hit some frozen chunks in there. So the ground, especially in the Northeast Kingdom and colder places where the snow persisted much longer, is probably still frozen to a certain degree. But if you're growing annuals, you're growing vegetables, that's not too much of a concern, because you're really more concerned about the first top foot or so of soil. If you have raised beds or if you're growing in containers, now is certainly a good time to plant. In fact, my wife and I have been planting peas, radishes, and spinach and lettuce. So because we have raised beds, the soil warms up fast, and we have had enough warm days for it to warm up, and those kinds of crops can germinate quickly. So you can be planting things this time of year, even though it may seem cold out there and rainy and cool and like it's not going to ever happen. Go ahead and plant some of those cool season crops. It will change really quickly. In the next couple weeks, it'll be up in the 70s. Everything will be happening. You'll forget all about this show.
If you promise.
I promise.
Right. Well, and I think people who maybe haven't spent a long time gardening, it's a little surprising to think that things like lettuces and spinach, which seem so delicate and certainly feel so delicate once you have them in your refrigerator and you see how quickly they wilt,
yes,
can actually survive in pretty cold weather.
Yeah, and the key with those, especially if you go to a greenhouse and you get seduced into buying six packs or something of them, is to harden them off a little bit. So even in a greenhouse, they have ideal growing conditions. You don't want to take them from the greenhouse, just pop them right in that cold soil on a cold day like today. So let them transition for a few days, maybe up to 5 days or so outside. The first day, maybe put them out for an hour or so, let them get used to in a part sun location out of the wind, and then bring them back inside, and then increase that amount of time outside and exposure to the wind until by the fifth day or so you can move them into the garden.
And all of those crops that you mentioned, the radishes, the spinach, the peas, the lettuces, you can get a nice round of crops in now, and then you can keep planting through
well,
the year.
Well, yes, there's all of that with succession planting. So if you can get things in early now, that same bed that you planted all those great early cool season crops, by midsummer, by July, they're pretty much done. So you can be ripping all that stuff out, planting another crop, maybe a crop of bush beans. You can plant bush beans, at least in the Champlain Valley and Connecticut River valleys, until the end of July and still get a crop. So you can put a crop of bush beans in, pull those out in early September, and then your third crop could be kale. You can be seeding kale or mesclun greens for the fall. So in one bed, you can actually have three different crops in 1 year. So that way you can really maximize the space that you're using in your garden. And you don't need to have those huge gardens. You can just have a real concentrated garden.
All right, let's go to Nick, who's calling in from Sunderland. Hey, Nick, go ahead.
Great, thanks for taking my call. So my question is about composting chicken waste. I have 25 or so chickens that overwinter in my garden, and then I move their coop and I take all of their waste and I pile it up in the center, and then my thought is to then spread it out and till it in. Is that enough time, you know, to compost? Is that a safe practice?
So you have it, it's all fresh waste now from the winter, and you want to till it in?
But
yeah, I would not do
it. Yes.
Yeah, I think it's probably not enough time for it to break down because it's still pretty fresh. A better thing to do would be to compost it, and you can compost it right in the garden if you like. Just keep it in a pile, maybe mix in some, I assume there's probably some carbon material, sawdust or wood chips or whatever you use for bedding, hay or straw. So let it kind of cook and let it kind of warm up and heat up. You'll know it when it's heating up because it'll actually steam sometimes and you can feel the warmth. Once it's gone through that cycle once or twice, then it's probably broken down enough that you can actually use it in the garden. But I wouldn't use it fresh right now.
And how long do you think it'll take to go through that cycle one or two times?
It might take a month or two to do that.
So yeah. Later in the season.
So later in the season, you probably could apply it.
All right. Thanks for the call, Nick. Let's talk to Judy in Facedon. Hi, Judy.
Hi, everybody. Jane. And,
hi.
I'm sorry. I've got your first name.
Charlie. It's still Charlie.
Much for mentioning about the rhododendron, and I've got two things. I think people should know how, when they're cutting off their evergreens, the pine trees, the angle at which the branches should be cut off, and I think that's an issue maybe. And the other thing is exactly where does one cut off the rhododendrons?
Okay, so with your rhododendron, it's always good whenever you're cutting a shrub or a tree to cut back either to a side branch or to some area where there's side branches going out. So with the rhododendron, you can go back and you can see where there's probably a combination of side branches going out in the direction you'd like it to continue to grow. So you cut to right above that. And that is a good way, that's the general pruning practice, so that will stimulate that growth of those branches or those buds, for that matter, to go out in the direction and fill in that area. If it's really cracked and split, you might have to go all the way back to the trunk. But then the nice thing about rhododendrons is you can cut into the old wood and have it leaf back out again. It isn't going to look pretty for a while, but it will eventually leaf out and fill back out again. So that would work pretty well.
And then Judy also mentioned for the pines and the evergreens, do you need to cut on a bias or can you cut straight up and down?
Well, when you're cutting back on a tree, you always want to cut back to what we call the branch collar. And that's a series of little cells, almost looks like wrinkled skin, like an elephant skin, right next to the trunk. If you look really close at trees, you can actually see it. So you want to cut back to that so you're leaving a little bit of a stub against the trunk or against the branch. And that little stub where the branch collar is, those branch collar cells reproduce really quickly and it'll grow very fast to heal over that wound. So don't cut flush and don't leave a big stub, but leave just a little bit of one so that it will heal as fast as possible, because that's the best way to get a tree to heal and not be reinfected by a disease. Don't use any tree paints or any of those sprays.
Okay, we're talking today with Charlie Nardozzi, gardening guru, about how to get the most out of your gardens this year, despite the chilly start. I know you have questions for him. You can post them on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, gardening expert Charlie Nardozzi is sharing his thoughts with us. We've been talking about how to repair the damage from this winter's harsh conditions and some of the ways you can prepare your soil. We're also going to do some forward thinking now to when it's going to be warm outside. Charlie promises maybe even this week, but certainly within the next couple of weeks, this cold, chilly weather will just be a bad dream.
Just a memory, that's all.
So if you have questions about the things that you anticipate growing or the seedlings you've got, you need to know when you can put them in the soil. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We've got some listeners who are still on this topic of soil and how to make sure that it's the best it can be. Mm-hmm. Michelle's calling in from Stowe. Hi, Michelle. Go ahead.
Hi, Charlie.
Hi.
So in the fall, I have a friend who has a small alpaca farm, and she gave me a couple of buckets full of alpaca poo, and I spread it all over my raised beds and around my garden area, you know, just anyway. So now in my raised beds, and I did that in October, and they've been in there all winter, and I kind of stirred them in a little bit, but not too deeply because I didn't want to mess with the microbes underneath. But now it's, you know, we're getting closer to actually putting things in there, and there's still the little pellets of alpaca poo looking much like they did in the fall in the garden. So I'm not sure if I should do something with that, put compost on top of it, or mix it in more, or if I've made a mistake, or what.
So what's Michelle's move, Charlie?
It's hard to make a mistake with poo. So did you put a lot of alpaca manure down?
Well, you know, it's define a lot. I don't know.
An inch, like, 2 inch thick layer. How thick of a layer did you put down?
Oh no. Well, so if there's still space between the nuggets, you know.
Oh,
like,
okay.
It's not like an inch thick or anything, but it's definitely well scattered in the soil.
Yeah, so it's probably fine. You know, alpaca manure probably has a lot of grasses in it. It's going to be a little bit slower to break down versus like a cow manure, for example. So I wouldn't be too worried about it. You know, just kind of, as you were saying, fluff your soil a little bit this spring, work it into the upper layers of the soil. If you're really concerned, you could bring in a little more finished compost before you seed or put your transplants in. But I don't think it's going to have any kind of toxicity to the young transplants. It's not like chicken manure from that previous caller where it can be really hot manure that can burn the roots of plants. Alpaca manure doesn't do that, so I think you'll be okay.
Ah, so there is a difference between chicken manure and alpaca manure.
Gotta know your manure.
Yeah, clearly. So I didn't realize it's not about the toxicity or about not wanting to have you know, anything that could be dangerous for your plants.
Yeah. With chicken manure, they have a lot of urea in the manure, and that's what makes it really hot and really, really high in nitrogen, which makes it great manure. But it also, if it's fresh, it can burn those young roots. Whereas something like horse, alpaca manure, sheep manure, those types of manures don't have that high content of urea, so they break down a little bit slower. They don't have as much nitrogen, but they're safer for young seedlings.
Got it. Okay. And still on soil, we'll go to Megan in Burlington. Hi, Megan.
Hi, yes, Charlie. My name's Megan, and it's good to be here. I went to your seminar last year. I had some moss in my garden, mm-hmm. which was obviously a shade problem. I took your recommendation and put 2 inches of compost and cleared the moss off. I now have a soil test that shows high phosphorus, potassium, and magnesium, like very high, mm-hmm. and low nitrogen. Mm-hmm. Now, I went to Master Gardener and Gardener's Supply, and everybody's stumped. So I wanted your thoughts on what to do. It's a really strange outcome.
Yeah.
And I didn't test before I composted, and everybody said I should have done that. So any rate, I don't have a test before I composted, but my garden was almost 100% intervale compost originally.
Okay, so you had a lot of compost in it, and you had moss in it, and you pulled the moss off, put the compost on, and tested it, and it's low in nitrogen but high in everything else.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So I think all you need to do is kind of think about what kind of source of nitrogen you can put into that garden, into those beds. So if it's a vegetable garden, which I kind of assuming it is, you can certainly start with things that fix their own nitrogen, like beans and peas or fava beans or anything like that. They'll grow fine in that kind of soil, and they will use the nutrients and then fix their own atmospheric nitrogen. For stuff like greens or broccoli or tomatoes, things that need more nitrogen, especially when they're young, I would just use a soluble form of it that's just nitrogen. So like a fish emulsion fertilizer with a little seaweed in it maybe, or any worm poop tea is another one. There's a number of organic ones out there. But when you look at the numbers, make sure that the first number is the highest one. That's nitrogen. And the other two are very low, if not zero. Because those are the ones you don't need. You don't need phosphorus, you don't need potassium, or the magnesium, I think, is the other one you mentioned. So use something that's really purely going to be a nice nitrogen form. Another way to approach it is to put the plants in there, and then if you have a lawn around there, you can take those fresh grass clippings, as long as you haven't treated your lawn with any chemicals, and put those as a mulch. And fresh grass clippings are high in nitrogen. You just mix them into the soil a little bit. As they break down, they'll feed the plant. So there's a number of ways to get the nitrogen in there without having to bring in other chemicals too.
All right. So if you have a question for Charlie, if you have soil problems or want some tips on maybe great new strains to grow of whatever vegetables you enjoy, our number is 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We got two questions from Dick, who writes in to say, number one, any help for Sclerodium sepivorum, a white mold in garlic and onions?
Okay, well, there's a very specific disease for you, yes. So a lot of those alliums will get a white mold that will actually cause the allium bulb itself to rot, either as it's growing or once it's mature or after you harvest it. From my understanding of white mold, it's not that easy of a disease to control. Probably the best thing to do would be to rotate crops. So plant your allium somewhere where you haven't planted them before. Don't come back to that soil again for at least 3 or 4 years, using other kinds of cover crops and other kinds of plants in that area so you can build up the organic matter. There is some belief, I think, that you can add like garlic powder, literally garlic powder, into the hole where you're planting the allium. And believe it or not, the garlic powder counteracts the fungus, which attacks the actual plant. So it's worth kind of a home remedy thing that I've read a little bit about that might work. So it might be worth a try.
Yeah, worth a try.
But there are no real chemicals per se, organic or otherwise, that are very effective.
Okay, so could you move it to a different bed, or is it something that's just going to keep coming back because of your location?
Well, I guess the first thing is if you're saving your own garlic bulbs or shallots or any of those types of things, you might consider getting a fresh batch because you don't want it to have overwintered with them and then you're just reinfecting your soil as you go along. So get some new garlic bulbs this summer when you're planting, or some onion bulbs if you're going to be planting from sets this year, or grow them from seed. But as you're saying, put them in a different spot, somewhere where they haven't had any alliums for a number of years, and see if that helps.
Okay, and Dick's second question is, he says, all right, also, I grow great pepper plants but have poor yields. Some years, no flowers at all, but the plants are large and bush-like. Dick says, I have tried Epsom salts and row covers.
Yes, it's all about the soil, isn't it?
Clearly today we should be doing the soil show.
No plants, all about the soil, no plants. So yes, when you have things that grow really well, really lush and green, like a pepper plant, this has been a common problem with a lot of people. What happens is that if you add too much nitrogen to your soil, you'll get that lush green growth, beautiful looking plants, but it'll be slow to flower and slow to set fruit. And with peppers in Vermont, that's critical because it takes so long for them to do both of those things. You don't want to have it delayed in any way, shape, or form. So what you'll probably need to do is to cut back on any kind of composted manure, any kind of nitrogen source of fertilizer that you've been adding to the soil. Don't do it. Just don't do it, because there's probably enough nitrogen in that soil to have those plants grow really well. So that would be probably the best solution. What happens when you have too much nitrogen is you create a nutrient imbalance in the plant. And so the phosphorus and the potassium and all the other nutrients that are necessary for flower and fruit formation just aren't there in adequate quantities because of the nitrogen.
Okay, Charlie, I have promised we were going to get beyond soil and talk about vegetables, but let me just pause before we do, because, I mean, this is a good time to be thinking about your soil and
yes.
certainly before you're planting. So we've got a couple more questions, and then we're going to move on to late blight. Got several late blight questions.
Always
do. And we're going to talk about other things. But Lori says, when gardening in raised beds of a large reusable cloth container type, is it mm-hmm. necessary to remove and replace soil every year, or can I just add fresh compost and rotate crops as I would with in-ground garden beds? She says, I used a purchased organic soil and compost mix last season to grow kale and tomatoes with good success.
Nice. Yeah. So ideally, yes, you would replace it every year, because there's chances are you've gotten some disease, some insect in there. And if these bags are not so large, it may not be that much you're replacing. The only caveat I would say is if you're growing something in a big container and it's taking a ton of soil, then maybe you could just dig down a foot or two, remove the top surface of that soil, and then put in some fresh soil. But in general, it's better to replace the whole thing.
Okay. And Mary says, what do you know about using human pee for fertilizers? And I might add to that, because I know people are now experimenting with composting toilets and other ways mm-hmm. of composting their own poop as well. So
right.
Human waste, what do you know about that as a fertilizer?
I know they've done some experiments. I think down in the Brattleboro area, they were doing some experiments using human waste on fields to see how it would work and contamination. That's about as much as I know about it. So I'm not really sure. I know for centuries, the Chinese traditionally have used human waste in their fields, and they've been going strong for a long time. So there's definitely a way to do it. As far as what the safest way and the correct way to do, I'm not exactly sure about that.
Okay, so to Mary's question about using human pee for fertilizer, she should do some research.
She should do some research,
great.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's talk about
blight,
Charlie.
Are we going to talk about something else?
Yeah, we're going to talk about tomatoes. We're
okay.
going to talk about some of the other things. We have two tomato blight emails mm-hmm. and some calls. Okay, so first of all, Jack in Claremont, New Hampshire says, can Charlie give some advice on preventing late blight affecting tomatoes? And let's go to Janet, who's both written in, and I think Janet may be on the line from Londonderry now. Hi, Janet. Go ahead. You have a late blight question,
there.
Too, right?
Yes, I certainly do. Not that most people would be worrying right now, but we have very old cages we made out of concrete reinforcing wire. The big rolls you buy, and mm-hmm. they're already rusty looking.
Yeah.
And we just, keep them tied in a roughly 2-foot diameter circle. And when the plants have been put in, and then before I would put straw around, or just about the time, put the straw around and set these cages. Now, this past summer, we had the worst ever late blight attack here. By the time I found out the proper thing to go buy at the hardware, it was too late. And so I've been thinking about this. Is it able to live over on the rusty concrete reinforcing wire cages? In other words, we go and do the same thing this year. Are we just bringing it back?
Mm-hmm. So if it's truly late blight, no, because late blight only overwinters on living tissue. So that means late blight attacks potatoes and tomatoes. So if you have like some spuds that you didn't dig out of the ground and then they germinate this spring and you get the new plant coming up and it has late blight on it, then it's going to infect that plant and all the other plants in your area. But it's not going to overwinter on the actual cages themselves or any stakes or any kind of materials. And in fact, it won't even overwinter on decomposing leaves. It's only on the fresh live tissue that it'll overwinter.
Okay, so to Jack's point about advice for preventing late blight affecting his tomatoes this year.
So prevention, probably the best thing to do is start looking for resistant varieties. And it is not too late to start tomatoes indoors, even though we're at the end of April. You still have time, and all you need is about 4 to 6 weeks or so, and then you can plant them probably Memorial Day or early June. So you can start them from seed. Some local companies like High Mowing has a variety called Iron Lady that is blight resistant. Johnny's over in Maine has a couple of varieties, Defiant and Mountain Magic. So a lot of people have been working on this problem, because not only late blight, but early blight, septorial leaf spot, a number of different foliar diseases of tomatoes has been a problem in the Northeast for years and years. So I would start with resistant varieties, get those out there, get those in the ground. Healthy soil is always a great thing. We'll go back to the soil again, adding manure, compost, keeping your plants healthy, spacing them out a little bit. I'm the biggest culprit in this one, because I try to cram everything in. But if you could add a little more space between the plants so you get good airflow, this is a fungal disease. So if it's wet leaves that are touching each other, that's going to be that's going to be the formula for them to really start from the bottom and working their way up, or in case of late blight, they'll just kind of take over the whole plant.
All right. So good advice there for preventing late blight. Peggy in Perkinsville has a question about quince. And I don't know if Peggy, you know, makes quince jam and gives it away to her neighbors, but I'm sure they're all hanging on their seats for this one if she does, because boy, is that good.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Peggy says, I have a quince bush which has never bloomed. What to do to get those wonderful salmon-colored blooms?
Huh. Well, it might be an issue of not enough sun, perhaps. If it's in too shady a spot, the flower buds aren't forming. You know, quince are one of those plants, like the lilacs, Forsythia spirea, that form their flower buds the year before. Then they go through the winter, and then, of course, they'll bloom in the spring pretty early. If it's a type of quince or a variety of quince that is not that necessarily hardy up here, that could be the reason those flower buds might die when we get a severe winter, like the last two that we've had. So I would take a look at what variety it is. Has it flowered in the past? If it's flowered in the past, then it's probably one that's adapted here, and maybe there's something else going on. If you've never really seen it flower,
yeah, it says never bloomed.
Never bloomed, it's probably not a hardy variety. So I would dig it up, give it to your cousin down in Connecticut, and buy yourself a new one.
Oh, how sad. We're talking today with Charlie Nardozzi. He's a gardening consultant. He'll come to your place if you go to his website, which we have a link to at vpr.net. But we've got him here right now, right with us. If you have questions, our number is 1-800-639-2211. Or post those questions and photos. If you're justifiably proud of your soil, you can post a photo on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're talking about how to get the most out of your garden this spring and on into the harvest season with gardening expert Charlie Nardozzi. You can share your questions on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or call us. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Maybe you just need some encouragement from Charlie, and that's what Jeremiah is looking for here. He says, can you have some advice or maybe just a word of encouragement for those of us dealing with infestations of gout weed? A couple of summers ago, I bought a house and found the perennial gardens overrun with this tenacious scourge. I don't want to resort to chemical remedies, but I've had some success with smothering new shoots in the spring with bark mulch. This requires that you frequently nip anything that pokes through. If I'm persistent enough, will I eventually exhaust the gout weed and rid my garden of this plague, or is there a more effective way to combat it?
Well, it is a battle of wills with goutweed and horsetail and Japanese bamboo and a number of those persistent weeds that we have in our environment. The downside of goutweed is that when it gets into things like a perennial garden or into a flower bed or something, it's really tough to just get rid of that. So what I would suggest doing is draw a line in the sand. It's like, you can live over there, but not over here. And then from that area over, you will be very diligent about pulling out as much of that goutweed as you can. Don't tip it, because if you break up any of those little roots, you're going to form little baby goutweed seedlings, and they'll just keep growing and growing. But on nice rainy days...
But baby goutweed is so cute, Charlie.
Oh, it is. Baby goutweed so cute. And actually, it's called Snow on the Mountain, and it's at the variegated form of it is pretty attractive. It's a great ground cover for the right place, and that's really the key with it. It's when it gets in the wrong places, then it becomes a weed, quote unquote. So I would just kind of draw that line, try to pull it out on a nice rainy day like today. The roots will be easy to pull out. Do that diligently, like he's talking about. If you have an area you want to reclaim a big swath of your garden or of your lawn or wherever it is, you can put down some black plastic, thick black plastic, weigh it down, really keep it there for a year or so, then pull it off, and then you're still going to get some coming in, but you've weakened it at that point, so you can actually pull it out easier. And then whatever area you've made clean of goutweed, put some kind of edging or border deep into the soil so the one that's nearby won't be able to creep back in.
Let's go to Bob, who's calling in from Mount Tabor. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You there, Bob?
Trying.
Oh, good. We got you. There you are.
I had you on speakerphone, and I couldn't figure out how to get it off. Hi. I had an asparagus patch for many, many, many years, and it finally dwindled and died. And I've waited a few years, and I want to put in a new patch, and I'm wondering if it's safe to put it like 30 or 40 feet from the old patch, and what variety Charlie would recommend for Vermont.
Yeah, okay. Yes, it's fine to do that, especially, as long as it's not in the exact same spot. You can put it close by, and it's not going to be really an issue. As far as varieties for Vermont, the Jersey series is usually the best one. There's Jersey Knight, Jersey Gem. There's a number of different ones out there, and if you Google them, you can get their descriptions.
Jersey Shore, no.
Jersey Shore, that's good. They should do that. I forgot which one it was. It might be Jersey Knight is good for clay soil. So they have different characteristics to them. So doing a little research online, you'll be able to find them. And you buy them, of course, as crowns, and now is a great time of year to plant them. Just when you plant them, remember, like you were saying, they're long-lived. So dig a nice size trench, make sure it's well-drained soil, amend the soil well with some compost, and really keep on top of the weeds for it, and they will last 20, 30, 40 years for you.
Yeah, remind people who are not familiar with growing asparagus, this is a crop that will keep reemerging
every
year.
Yes, this is a perennial, and the nice thing about the Jersey series is they're all male, meaning that you don't get any females, which are those little red berries. Those are female plants. My experience is you'll still get a few, but you won't get a lot of them. If you use some of the old-fashioned varieties like Martha Washington or some of those will have a lot of females in it. And what the little berries do is they drop to the ground. They sprout little baby asparagus, which you think are cute, but they just end up crowding out the other plants and become a weed. So it's nice to have the all-male. They're more productive. They're more adapted to our soils and our climate, and you don't have to deal with the weeding.
So should you pull the females if you get a few of them?
You could pull a few of those out, yeah.
Okay. All right, so we got a note from Beth who says, how can I grow fractal cauliflower, that beautiful pale green Italian cauliflower?
Fractal cauliflower.
Yeah, I mean, I am not sure, but you know those pictures of cauliflowers that have those beautiful shapes? If you take a picture from the top down, it's that
spirals?
Green cauliflower. Yeah,
the Romanesco.
So beautiful.
Yes, yes, yes. The Romanesco cauliflower is what she's talking about.
Well, Romanesco, that's an Italian word,
that's
right?
A very
so she's
Italian
close.
Word. Yeah, she's very good. So you grow those just like you grow regular cauliflower. They're a little longer season. My experience, at least in my garden, is we grow cauliflower as a fall crop, not as a spring crop, because a lot of times you put it in now or very soon, and then we get some hot weather come June, July or so, and it doesn't really head up very well. It gets what we call ricey really quickly. So it just is really much tougher. If you plant it in July as a transplant and then harvest it more towards September, October, then the cooler weather, you can actually hold your cauliflower in the garden for longer periods of time. And the Romanesco is an easy one to get as a seed. You would just start the seed maybe 4 to 6 weeks before you're going to transplant it into the garden. So when you think you're done with seed starting, you're actually still doing it for these, probably in mid-May, end of May, sometime around there is when you want to start the seed. And then transplant it into the garden and then just keep the cabbage worms and things off them, and they should produce for you.
All right, but if Beth or others really want to see some Italian gardens, they can do it with you later this year, right?
Ah, great segue.
Thank you. Yes. That's what I'm known for.
Yes, I am taking a tour, a garden and food tour of Sicily. This fall, September 24th to October 3rd, we are going to explore the wonders of this historic island. It goes back thousands of years. It's a crossroads of civilizations. The Greeks have been there, the Spanish, the Romans, Arabians, a lot of different influences in this culture. And not only are we going to visit private and public gardens all along the south and the east coast, we'll go up to Mount Etna and discover a little bit about what Mount Etna is all about. We'll be doing cooking classes, in fact, one at an herb nursery. So we'll be doing some herb cooking with native herbs from Sicily. And if we're lucky, we'll go to the Bronte Pistachio Festival.
Ooh.
Because the slopes of Mount Etna are very fertile soil. They grow a lot of oranges and a lot of pistachios. So if you're interested, go to my website, gardeningwithcharlie.com. All the information is there.
Charlie, we have managed to make it almost through the whole show without really going into pests and pest control. So
well, it is April, Jane.
I know it's true, but people are already concerned about this. So let's carve out a little bit of time here for some pests. First of all, pests of the large variety. John in Hyde Park says, we have a small deer herd that we see grazing on the field grass behind our vegetable garden. I picked up a brochure on a product called Deer Defeat at a local nursery, and I've read all of the positive reviews on the company website. Do you know if this product really works? And if not, any ideas for keeping deer away?
Yeah, I don't know Deer Defeat. That's a new one for me. So I would look at the active ingredient and see what it is and kind of determine from that. Usually the repellents, if they're smell-based, they'll have things like rotten eggs, cayenne pepper, blood meal, something like that in them that would be used as a deterrent. Any of the sprays will work for a time. So they'll work for a week or two, and then the deer get used to them, or they rain and washes them off, and then they'll be back again. So my suggestion usually is to have 3 or 4 different types and rotate them and be really diligent about spraying, especially this time of year. As new leaves come out, you'll get new growth very quickly. Within a week, you have a whole new set of leaves. So you need to keep reapplying it onto that new growth so that the deer don't attack it. The one that seems to work the best for me is one called Plant Skid. That's spelled S-K-Y-D-D. It is Swedish. For the plant skid itself means protection. And they have been testing this up in Sweden in forests in the winter where deer have very little to eat, and on trees and shrubs, and it keeps them away. So it is a very potent smell. Let me just say it that way. It is a blood meal kind of product. And when you spray it, it smells like a slaughterhouse. But it dissipates quickly. You just have to make sure you don't leave your dog out, because they'll go crazy over this stuff. Mm-hmm. But once it's dry, the smell is gone. The dog is not interested. But it lasts on the plant for months, supposedly, and keeps deer away. And I've had some good success with so far with it.
Okay. So we'll go to a smaller pest now. Mm-hmm. Judith says, last year I followed Charlie's advice and applied a liberal spraying of beneficial nematodes. Ding, ding, ding. We always have to say that at least once a show. She says she sprayed it in the areas where Japanese beetles had been a bad problem the previous year. Nevertheless, these areas were swept by a tidal wave of Japanese beetles last year. There were thousands of them on our beans, on roses, on asparagus foliage. Wave after wave, they kept coming until frost. Is there any more effective way to prevent another infestation this summer?
Well, the Japanese beetles are very mobile, and you get a summer like last year, especially if you're in a situation where you're out in the open and the beetles can be flying all over the place. They find you, and once they find them, they kind of send the message out, and everybody comes, their brothers or cousins, everybody comes to join the party. So the beneficial nematodes do work, but they're obviously only going to work on the ones laying eggs around your plants. So I would still continue with that. That's still a good idea. It's a microscopic little wire worm that you spray in June onto the soil areas around plants where they were feeding, like the grapes and the plants you mentioned, and you water them in well, and they will parasitize those white grubs, those C-shaped grubs that are in the soil now. And as you're digging, you'll probably uncover a bunch of those. So that's a good way to kind of try to break that life cycle of the Japanese beetle, to kill a bunch of the grubs so you have fewer adults. For the adult itself, though, for the ones that are flying in, you can use Japanese beetle traps if you can figure out how they're coming into your yard.
So that you're not attracting them, rather.
Right.
Than,
so yeah. Trying to intercept them as they're coming in with a trap. And so keep them at least a couple hundred yards away from your plants. That's a good idea. I always joke that you can always give your neighbor one for Christmas, and then they go over there. But it is better to trap on a community-wide basis than just in your own yard.
It takes a village.
It takes a village. You can handpick them early in the morning. They're very sluggish. Dropping them into soapy water kills them pretty quickly. You can even just put a basin of soapy water under the bush and shake it, and they'll just roll and drop right in there if you don't want to actually pick them. But the latest news in the Japanese beetle world, of course, is a new organic pesticide that supposedly, and I put that again in quotes because I've not used it yet, will kill not only the grubs but the adults. And it is a form of Bacillus thuringiensis. Now that, if for those who know things about vegetable gardening, that's the BT, thuricide, dipel, number of names for it, that you use for cabbage worms. You can use it for Colorado potato beetles. It works for mosquitoes, larvae. It works on a bunch of different things. It's been around for a long time, very effective and very safe for the environment, for us, for animals. There is a new form that's been discovered that supposedly attacks not only the grubs, but the adult Japanese beetle. So I've got some of it.
You're going to try it.
And for a small fee, I can get you some. No. I'm going to try it this summer, and I will let you know how it does.
Okay, good. I want to hear about that. Nicole posts on our Facebook page saying, I'm new to gardening, and I'm planting a lot of new varieties of tomatoes. Are they going to cross-pollinate? I'd like to save seeds if possible, but I want to make sure I know what I'll get next year.
Yes. So, well, first of all, if you have a hybrid, saving the seeds of a hybrid will not ensure you'll get that same variety. So assuming you're using heirlooms or open-pollinated varieties, you can save the seeds. But you have to be very diligent about not letting them cross-pollinate, because even though tomatoes are wind-pollinated, meaning they don't need to have bees coming in to cross-pollinate, the bees will come anyway because they like the pollen. So what you should do is that when you have a cluster of flowers of a tomato variety that you like, make sure it gets pollinated, and then somehow cover that plant with like a floating row cover or some kind of protection so that the bees don't get in there to actually pollinate it. And ideally, you would put your tomatoes in different sections of a large garden so that they won't find them, but they're probably going to find them anyway. So you need to somehow isolate the plants that you want to save the varieties from in order to get that variety to be true the next year.
Okay, but you said wait until after it's been pollinated?
Well, once the flower opens, just jiggle it a little bit on that morning that it opens fully, and it should be pollinated at that point, and then you can just cover it. Or you can just cover it even before then, before it's open. The idea is that it just needs to be moved a little bit so that the pollen will actually fertilize the egg.
Okay, a couple more quick ones. Ray in Hinesburg says, how can I get parsnips to germinate, and when should I plant them so they don't get too big?
Yeah, so parsnips, I love cool weather. You can be planting them pretty soon, next week or so. They like a well-drained soil, so a nice compost-laden soil, maybe a little sand or something in it. What they do in England is that they actually use a little dibble. They stick it in the ground, make a big long hole, stick the seed at the top, not too deep. That's the key with parsnips. Don't bury the seed way down, but just below the surface of the soil. Keep it moist, and it takes a couple weeks, so be patient with your parsnips.
All right, and another seed question before we let you go. Rick in Westford wants to know the best way to plant things like carrots, which have tiny seeds. Rick says, I struggle to make sure that I space single seeds in rows, but it's tedious. My wife tosses a fistful into the ground and then runs a rake over them. Neither method seems ideal.
Yeah. Little seeds like carrots are tough, and you're going to have to thin them one way or another. You could mix them in with a little sand when you're doing that, and then sprinkle the sand on the ground. That will separate the seeds a little bit more, so maybe not on top of each other as much. Certainly better than the fistful seed method. So using that method would probably be a good thing. And, of course, you can keep in mind that little seedlings of carrots, you can eat the tops. They're very tasty. So as you pull them out, think of them as a salad green and not
That's
a carrot.
See, that makes it less of a burdensome
task.
It's
not as hard, right?
Charlie Nardozzi is the host of the VPR Garden Journal. He's an all-around gardening expert and consultant. We have a link to his website at vpr.net. Charlie, thank you.
You're very welcome.
And we got a note from Joe Tilley, a research specialist with the UVM Plant Science Department, says, just want to let folks know they can get their soil tested at the UVM Ag Testing Lab in Jeffords Hall on the UVM campus in Burlington. To ensure getting your soil test results before Memorial Day weekend, they should arrive at the lab no later than noon this Friday or next Friday, May 8th. All right, so a tip there if you're still on the soil question. All right, that'll do it for today. Tomorrow, how overpopulation is changing the world. We'll talk to Vermonters who are working to bring attention to the exploding population and its outsized impact on the Earth's environment and people. You can share your thoughts on that by writing to Vermont Edition at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.